and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, back in the hot seat after 2 weeks away following the birth of my little son, Sai. Aww. Many thanks to Zan Brooks for so deftly filling in for me as your host during that time. Zan will be back a little bit later to grapple with the week's reviews, including Richard Curtis's The Boat That Rocked and Monsters vs. Aliens. Will I like cartoons any better, I wonder, for now being a daddy? Elsewhere, Film Weekly gets musical. I talk to the brilliant composer Michael Nyman about his ever-changing career, including his latest experiments with Polish cinema and accordions. And then I'll be pulling on the leather-studded glove, tightening the toweling headband, and spreading out my cardboard mat as we mark the 25th anniversary of Breakdance the Moving with Alfredo Shabadoo Quiñones. Ain't no stopping us, no one does it better. We're Film Weekly. Michael Nyman is one of Britain's most accomplished and acclaimed composers. His vast repertoire includes operas, string quartets and ballets, but he's best known as composer of film soundtracks, from Peter Greenaway's The Cook, The Thief, The Wife and His Lover to Michael Winterbottom's The Claim, and of course his award-winning score to the piano. Most recently, his compositions form the backdrop to the Oscar-winning Man on Wire documentary. But has he had enough of film? It seems not. Michael Nyman's latest project sees him turn his attention to Polish cinema. Next week at the Kinoteka 7th Polish Film Festival in London, Nyman performs the world premiere of his latest work, Music to Write Films To, a celebration of classic Polish film images, collaborating with the cutting-edge Polish accordion group Motion Trio. I met up with Michael Nyman at his London home to find out why he's going back to his roots.
This commission, which came as a kind of music commission, the music is less important to me than the visual. Because, I mean, it's kind of incredible. The Polish Cultural Institute commissioned this piece, rather brilliant idea, and they said, make a 20-minute film, montage, your word, out of any Polish films that I choose. Mm-hmm. It had to be image-based rather than dialogue-based. But then the most extraordinary thing that happened was that the last film I saw, and I don't know why I kind of left it at the bottom of the pile, was André Munch's Passenger, which I'd never seen.
No, I've never seen it.
Well, it is the most powerful Auschwitz film you could ever imagine. It was unfinished, and the concentration camp scenes are unbelievably powerful.
Oh, your roots.
My background is Polish. Yeah, one set of grandparents came from Czestochowa.
Have you done the retracing your roots journey?
Yeah, I did. I went with Waldemar Januszczak in 1985 to the birthplace of my paternal grandparents. You know, there has to be some kind of Polish instinct behind all this.
You've given it a bit of Polish umpah.
No, it's basically the Michael Nyman Band and the Motion Trio,
who I've seen on film, and they're quite extraordinary. They've taken the accordion to new heights, which I think it probably needed doing, didn't it?
New heights and new widths, because they are three very large gentlemen.
That brings to a close the Kinoteka kind of festival that's been on here in London, and then goes on tour around the country, which I suppose is kind of fascinating for you to do that here, to do it live. But what people do know about your work is your composition that you touched on for other people. Are you still doing that? Because it seems to have been a while, unfortunately.
No, the last film I did actually was a film that was not seen over here called Never Forever, which was a first feature from the only woman Korean director called Gina Kim. Oh. And I wrote a very sweet score for that, and shown in Sundance 2 or 3 years ago. I'm now kind of absent from soundtracks.
Mm-hmm. Is this because you've changed your style over the years? I mean, people kind of know your style with Greenaway, and then you sort of carry that on into the work that you do with Michael Winterbottom, the wonderful score for Wonderland, the lovely work you did for The Claim as well. And is that because people don't quite know what a Michael Nyman score is now? You seem to be so protean and changing and taking in world influences.
I mean, the music I wrote for Greenaway was the music that I write for myself. Mm-hmm. So it's nothing to do with Greenaway. And if you look at my non-film work over those 30 years since I've been a composer, you know, it's pretty consistent. the music I write for an opera or a string quartet could find its way into a Greenaway film. And I remember when Jane Campion called me and offered me the piano, and she explained why she thought I was the best composer for the job. She said, "You are the best composer for the job. Da, 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 da. I want you to write this score, but I don't want any of that Greenaway shit." And I don't know whether I kind of reply with that Greenaway shit. In fact, it's not Greenaway shit, it's Nyman shit. So I then, obviously, because of the subject matter of the film, I had to, you know, find other resources within my imagination, whatever. And then that became the kind of model for the music that composers like Winterbottom tapped into for Wonderland, not so much of the claim, and that's what Neil Jordan was familiar with The End of the Affair, Andrew Niccol with Gattaca. And it's very strange that I've not really, apart from the Libertine, there's really not much connection between what I've done since the piano and what I did with Greenaway as a film composer. So the piano has kind of been very useful, but very damaging.
Where is the art of film composition now, Michael? I go and see these Hollywood blockbusters every week, and there's a Hans Zimmer and a Howard Shore, or God Save Us Together at last, both Hans Zimmer and Howard Shore working together. And it seems that they're everywhere, that they're kind of imposing their dark themes over Batman and in whatever film it happens to be. And it seems to be so terribly bankrupt and short of ideas to me. I presume you're going to agree with me, unless you're going to get slung out of the Film Composers Union.
Well, I've already been slung out, or maybe I kind of pushed myself out or walked out. I don't know. I don't see many of these films. I mean, there are one or two composers that do interest me. And occasionally Hans Zimmer comes up with an amazing score. Thin Red Line, I thought was absolutely brilliant.
Given that you're now making your own films and that your music has kind of is widening in its influence, taking your own roots, taking the world journeys that you've made, when all is said and done, though, people will remind themselves of the work that you did with Greenaway that you say is Nyman music. Yeah. What would you like when, I'm not writing you off at all, but in the end, when they say, well, what typified Michael Nyman's work, what would you like it to be? Which one of them? Have you done it yet?
I'm still doing it. If I wasn't still doing it, I wouldn't bother. But as I say, there is something very comfortable and comforting about being able to say to James Marsh, for instance, from Man on Wire, take anything from my archive that you like and make your film around it.
Well, I look forward to you doing the next Match of the Day theme tune. It's about time you did football again.
Well, I did pitch for the big match. I was up against U2, Beautiful Day. And everyone said, no, yours is much more interesting. I said, U2 is pop music. Pop music always wins, whatever. And it did win. But, you know, maybe there are some QPR developments that I can't talk about yet.
Well, if you can't go down West London and see you at QPR, you can go down to the Barbican and see you performing with the Motion Trio and the Michael Nyman Band. Thank you so much for coming on Film Week. Okay. Joining me to discuss the rest of the week's releases, also out this Friday, is Zan Brooks. Welcome, Zan. Nice to have you back in Out of My Seat.
It's very nice to be back in my comfortable old armchair here.
Because you don't have to do any of the links.
Exactly. The links kill me.
Well, let's start with the films that are out this Friday. One of them, unless you've been submerged somewhere on the bottom of the Atlantic, you would have noticed that The Boat That Rocked is out. This is Richard Curtis, of course, the creator of Notting Hill and much besides, and the director of Love Actually. Directing his second film, The Boat That Rocked, tells the story of 8 DJs on a pirate radio ship, Radio Rock. However, Parliament is not happy about it. Let's hear Kenneth Branagh about to shut them down.
Now, there is one final matter to discuss. Pirate radio. Oh, no. In whose department does this fall?
That would be me, Prime Minister.
What's the plan, Sir Alistair? They're very popular. And they're not actually breaking any law that we know.
Oh, we're going to shut them down within the year. They are a sewer dirty and irresponsible commercialism and low morals.
Indeed. Very well, I leave it in your capable hands.
Thank you very much, Prime Minister.
That's Papa Doodle Doo, Zan. Pirate Radio, Radio Caroline. I used to listen under my bedclothes at night.
You weren't old enough for Radio Caroline.
It was going on, Radio Caroline. That's the whole thing. This is the thing. This film is set in 1966 or 67.
Yes.
I'm sure Radio 1 was invented by then.
No, I think Radio 1 was 67.
Okay, so this was the start. They punched all this lot.
But, of course, it takes a whole lot of liberties with history, not least the bit that we heard there with Kenneth Branagh as the epitome of this very, very stuffy, obviously kind of conservative government who wants to shut them down. You know, this is 66. This was like the Harold Wilson government,
yeah,
who was probably more of a man of the people than Richard Curtis perhaps is. So, you know, it does sort of slightly ride roughshod over things in the interest of rock and roll.
So, big cast here, Bill Nighy, Rhys Ifans, Nick Frost, Stephen O'Dowd, Kenneth Branagh, Jack Davenport. The list is endless and rather dull, it seems to me. But is it funny, Zan? That's what we want to know about Richard Curtis. Is the man behind Blackadder? Surely it's amusing.
I didn't find it particularly funny, but I have to say I'm not a big Richard Curtis fan, and with that in mind, I actually found this less kind of enraging than, say, Notting Hill or Love Actually, which I actively despised. This, I thought, was generally pretty harmless, but that's not really a ringing endorsement.
Really? Because I don't mind Notting Hill.
I
don't mind Love Actually, even. It's on. I think there are funny bits in it. I think there are occasionally kind of nice bit written bits. I mean, yes, they're all a bit sickly and they're hardly kind of great cinematic. But this, The Boat That Rocked, I just thought was flaccid, bloated. It goes on for over 2 hours. There's no need for it. There's no story. I didn't care about any of the characters, apart from Philip Seymour Hoffman, who is fantastic in it.
Yeah, but even Philip Seymour Hoffman is kind of channeling the spirit of Lester Bangs, who he played in Almost Famous.
Exactly.
It's kind of, you know, he's just sort of doing a kind of karaoke retread of an earlier film.
He is, but all the other kind of Nick Frost, Stephen O'Dowd, what were their characters? What were they doing? There's annoying Australian DJs. I mean, this lot were even more annoying than the DJs they sort of allegedly are.
Annoying
than David Lee Travis. Yeah. More annoying. I mean, that's extraordinary feat.
Yeah, they're taking these sort of superficial caricatures and then making them a bit more superficial.
And if I see one more shot of someone in a Sergeant Pepper's blazer turning around, pointing at the camera, going, "Hey, I will die." And another cutaway shot of nurses doing the twist around the radio on a beach. I mean, spare me, Zach.
Yeah.
I thought it was bereft of ideas and bereft of gags, which is, I think, what's unforgivable.
It's spectacularly unfunny. You know, like I say, I didn't hate it, I guess, as much as you, but it isn't funny. It isn't truthful. It doesn't have characters that are convincing. And also, it is just this thing of celebrating the wild free spirit of rock and roll in such a sort of cheesy way by a man who is, I think, the kind of the epitome of sort of safe conservative England. It didn't kind of square.
He should have been doing Genesis.
He should have been doing Genesis. You know, having said all that, good soundtrack there.
I mean, you can't go wrong if you're playing Let's Spend the Night Together and you're dancing in the street.
Yeah,
I mean,
the box tops and all that.
But what I thought was a massively missed opportunity, I didn't really understand why he was making it. Yes, it was great that there was pirate radio and the kind of the nation was under their bedclothes being naughty boys listening to this radio and pop music. But it didn't actually kind of get the spirit of pop music or the spirit of rebellion that might have entailed or the spirit of what it was rebelling against. Didn't get the impression that Britain was a dull place that needed enlivening. I didn't even get the impression that we were about to win that we won the World Cup while this was going on.
No, there was no reference to any of that. I mean, partly you could say that that's dictated by the actual thing of most of the action being set on a boat out in the North Sea. But no, it didn't. For a film that was supposedly about the outbreak of revolution and the 6 months that changed the world and everything, it didn't have any of that. It was just kind of faintly cheesy.
And where did they get the music from? How were they plugged into any scene whatsoever? Were they cool? Did the bands like them? And why were the women would just bust into this ship on little tugboats and then they were shagged and then let? I mean, I thought it was incredibly misogynistic.
Very dodgy sexual politics, which maybe you could argue it's a kind of pastiche of the unreconstructed kind of era that it's set in. But that's a kind of convenient argument, isn't it? Because you can still then have the Dolly Birds running around in some very kind of lame sex comedy, like from the sort of, you know, Carry On era.
That's what it reminded me of. Carry On is one of my notes written here. awful to see January Jones, brilliant Betty from Mad Men, stand here as just some kind of like airheady American slag. If you don't mind me saying, who has an affair with Reese Ifans, of all things.
Yeah, she has impeccable taste, doesn't she? I mean, the thing that I remember what they said about Love Actually, Richard Curtis's last film as a director, it was almost like a kind of cynical greatest hits package of Richard Curtis mannerisms. Yeah. Whereas this is almost like a worse. This is like a kind of cynical greatest hits package of Britpop, British pop from the 60s that does all the kind of heavy lifting. So whenever you kind of feel that he's run out of ideas and can't quite have a gag to end the scene, he then drops in a song that everyone goes, oh, wow, that's a great song. And that's almost kind of serving the purpose of the gag, where the gag should be you've got a kind of a bit of Rolling Stones.
Absolutely, which is extremely lazy. No Beatles, I noticed, because they never get any Beatles rights to right. these things. They're still very protective of them. But yes, good music, Richard. It was hardly the kind of stuff you've never heard from the 60s, you know, unless, I suppose, if you're a kid, you don't know the kind of nostalgia radio and whatever. But I mean, there was no new music on here that I'd never heard.
No, not at all. But then that's the point, I think. I don't think Richard Curtis is trying to introduce us to kind of interesting stuff we haven't heard, because he won't
classics.
Have heard it either. This is just basically ticking the boxes.
Yeah. Okay, Zan. Well, I think the boat that rocked is the boat that sunk. You know, one of the biggest jokes is the fact that Jack Davenport's character is called Twat.
Which they actually do that joke about maybe 15 times in the film. You've got Kenneth Branagh saying, I like you, Twat. And you think, is this inherently funny? And if so, is it inherently funny the 15th time we hear it?
No, it isn't.
It's not.
Twat. Let's move on to cartoon world, Monsters versus Aliens. As I said, I've been away seeing my new son into the new world, and I'm wondering if I will be enlightened to predisposed to liking cartoons more now that I have a baby son to show them through. So DreamWorks arrives as if on cue with Monsters versus Aliens, the story of Reese Witherspoon, who, because she's been hit by a meteorite, grows extremely large and becomes a monster, locked in a security depot with all the other monsters who've been haunting the world, and then the aliens come down, and do you know what? I'm going to get Keith Sutherland, who plays General W.R. Munger, get it? He's in charge of the monster compound. He's explaining how Ginormica, that's Reese Witherspoon, has got out of control, and President Hathaway has to sanction use of the monsters in a fight against the aliens.
Her entire body radiates with pure energy, giving her enormous strength and size. Sir, these monsters are our best and only chance to defeat that robot.
Don't we already have an alien problem, General? I don't think we need a monster problem, too.
You got a better idea, nerd.
Okay,
stay where you are. General, I propose we go forward with your monsters versus aliens idea thingy.
Zan, as I tried to explain, there's quite a difficult premise
it
to
is
set
really,
up
isn't
this
it?
One.
Yeah.
I'm obviously channeling sort of sci-fi 50s B movies.
Yes, but for a pretty kind of dunderheaded, simplistic film, it is quite convoluted setup, isn't it?
It is. I mean, obviously that's the 50-foot woman. There's a bit of
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Creature from the Black Lagoon is in
there.
And
the war room is totally Doctor Strangelove,
yeah,
isn't
it? Yeah, it is. And of course, the Day the Earth Stood Still, yeah. Which we've had remade by Keanu Reeves recently.
Very well, I recall.
Brilliant film it was. This one is DreamWorks. It's in 3D, so I had to sit there with those glasses on. This film didn't really have the beauty of 3D. I thought Bolt, a recent Pixar film, had a lot of beautiful kind of work with the 3D. This one had occasional what they do with 3D is go, look, it's in 3D, here's a ball throwing
out
of the
screen
at you.
Yeah. Here's a meteor coming right at you. Here's the giant woman roller skating on some cars across a bridge.
Yeah.
And so they really felt kind of shoehorned in. This is the 3D moment. This is what makes the film worthwhile. And you think, well, that's all very well. But, you know, for all those fireworks, you kind of need something behind it. And you need, like, you know, a script, maybe.
Yeah.
And interestingly, that this script is written, is credited to, like, 7 different screenwriters.
And you could feel it, though.
And you could feel it just being kind of pulled every which way.
And there's lots of different climaxes. And there was one bit where they kind of, a robot attacks the Golden Gate Bridge. And I thought, oh, brilliant, we're nearly finished. We've only done 18 minutes.
No way.
Carry carries on and on. Would you like to explain whether you liked any of the characters? Because I thought this was just DreamWorks do this. I think Pixar have got a kind of heart to their films that I like that John Lasseter
totally
does.
Agree. And the Pixar film that obviously this reminded me of was Monsters, Inc., where the monsters in Monsters, Inc. are all kind of believable in a weird way, you know, considering how outlandish they look and how there's so much comedy about the fact that they're monsters. You still kind of believe in them. Here, you don't really. They were, you know, as superficial as the DJs in The Boat That Rocked.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're played by these very professional comedians who obviously go in and do a bit of microphone work like we're doing here today. Seth Rogen, Paul Rudd, Will Arnett, Rainn Wilson, all these comedians from like the Saturday Night School, all the Seth Rogen School. Hugh Laurie is one of them. He's actually, I thought he was quite good as the kind of cockroach professor. But all the jokes seem to be, oh my God, my back's falling off. Oh my God, there's my back. I'm so zany. And they weren't funny though.
They weren't funny. But for all that, it's kind of entertaining. I mean, in a very kind of cheap way. Mm. This felt like a real kind of cheap thrill film. Where Pixar seemed to be going for the kind of the more adult crossover audience, this seemed determinedly pitched at sort of 7-year-olds.
Yeah, really. And I think they would like it as well.
I think they would, yeah, I think they would. So it's a lot of slapstick. It's a lot of kind of, mad, wild, crazy goings on, people falling over, people shouting. And it just gets a bit wearing, I think, for kind of old guys like us.
Yeah, it was.
Sitting there with our pathetic glasses
on. But I do think there's
a
difference. When you say that Pixar go for the adult, I think they go for the adult without ever kind of alienating the
children.
Absolutely,
yeah. Because
their stories seem to be very loving, very inclusive, very touching in a way. There's no emotion in Monsters vs. Aliens at all.
No, there isn't at all. It feels like a kind of fairground ride, really.
Actually, it probably will be one of these days soon.
Well,
Sam, talking of fairground rides, there's one that crops up in our next film called Religulous, directed and written by Larry Charles in conjunction with Bill Maher. He's the stand-up comedian who goes around the world taking the mickey out of religion, including one Holy Land theme park in Florida. Here's Bill Maher talking to U.S. Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas.
We are now among industrialized modern nations the most religious nation. A recent study found that among 32 countries, more people in this country doubted evolution than any other country on that list, except I think it was Turkey.
In the U.S., we have freedom of religion.
I think most of the countries on that list do have freedom of religion.
Well, it's interesting.
Do you believe in evolution?
You know, I don't know. Clearly, the scientific community is a little divided on some of the specifics of that, and I understand that.
I don't think they are.
No,
I think they pretty much agree.
I don't know how it all happened. I mean, I'm certainly willing to
accept it couldn't possibly have been Adam and Eve 5,000 years ago with a talking snake in a garden, could it?
Well, it could have possibly been that.
Come on.
Zan, I say religulous. Jonathan Ross, I noticed, says religulous. Larry Charles, when I spoke to him, says religulous, as in ridiculous, because this is what the film's about. It's a documentary, Michael Moore style, to show the kind of Pharisee attitude, the hypocritical attitude of organised religion around the world, I think.
I think we have to go with Larry Charles, don't we, in the pronunciation. He has the final word on the word.
He wrote it and invented it.
This is basically Bill Maher kind of with a stacked deck, I think, really. I think he kind of had made his mind up before he went in, don't you think?
He was not going to be...
He wasn't going to be converted. Well, there wasn't going to be a kind of road to Damascus. Kind of, actually, he's there, and he's in me, and I love him.
I met God, and he was dressed as Jerry Seinfeld. This is Larry Charles, the man behind this, who also made the Borat movie.
Yes, there's a lot of that there. A lot of its kind of tricks.
The ambush humour.
The ambush humour, the gotcha humour. The kind of setting people up for what they think is going to be a fairly innocuous interview and then making them look really dumb.
Now, do you think that's fair in documentary, especially when you're dealing with something as serious as religion?
Do you know, I found it kind of weirdly fair in Borat. I mean, what annoyed me about Borat was that some of the scenes seemed a little staged. But generally, I think that Borat had a point. Mm. This, I felt... It was more about Bill Maher than it was about religion, in a way. It was like what Bill Maher reckons to religion, and he reckons that everyone who's religious is stupid, and here they are being stupid. And so he will interview them, make them look foolish, and then for good measure kind of talk to the camera afterwards and say, weren't they dumb? And intercut their interviews with kind of, you know, archive footage from films and that make them look even more stupid.
And some subtitles going,
and subtitles.
Actually, that statistic is not correct.
Exactly.
And that's not fair, is it?
It's kind of not fair. It's a cheap... tactic, I think.
And given that you are, he's preaching to the converted.
He's
you
totally
and I are
preaching
sit there
to
and gonna
the
go,
converted. You know, this film comes, you know, boasted as from the producers, the studio that brought you Fahrenheit 9/11, and it's the same deal. That basically, this is totally preaching to the converted. Nobody from the Bible Belt is ever going to go and see this film. Nobody who's not a kind of Hollywood liberal probably is going to see this. And Bill Maher, in a way, is the epitome of what the Bible Belt people would hate anyway. He's like the epitome of the kind of the silver-maned Hollywood liberal who doesn't listen, he's very kind of loves the sound of his own voice. They're never going to be converted by this at all. So you think, well, who then, what is he trying to achieve with this?
To be fair to Bill Maher, he's not wandering around saying there is no God, you're all mad. He is saying, just think about it for a bit and
there
doubt it.
There's totally serious points here, particularly in his final monologue, where yes. he basically says that religion is an enabler of violence and basically lays this big charge sheet at its door, all of which I kind of happen to agree with. And I totally agree with the thrust of this documentary. I just think you can respect these people a bit more and maybe talk to some people who aren't like, you know, truckers at a trucker chapel
and
some
truckers.
Idiot who thinks that he's the second coming of Jesus and things like that. There are The fact is that there are really, really bright, intelligent people who believe in God. Let's hear from them.
Yeah, absolutely. And then he goes to rabbis who are inventing ways to get around Shabbat by kind of inventions. These people are a bit meshuggah, a bit mad anyway.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
You know, we know that. And you're right. There's no reason. He doesn't actually talk to someone who might make you think the other way, Pascal-wise, kind of to kind of load the dice and make a bet.
A proper sparring partner. Yeah. And he, you know, and the fact that he doesn't have a proper sparring partner suggests that he's running scared a little bit.
Yeah, there are some funny moments. And as you say, if you are converted, then you'll probably kind of find some food. And there is some definite thought here and almost a bit moving. I thought the film slightly has lost its power. Yeah. And the Christian right comes in and they believe in the end of days and they're going to launch Armageddon upon us all and we're all doomed. Actually, now Barack is in, maybe this is not really what we need to worry about.
Maybe not, although the issues of fundamentalist religion aren't going to go away, no matter, you know, who's in the White House. So I think it still has a kind of pertinence, unfortunately.
Zan, I genuflect before you and your reviews this week. Thank you so much for joining us. And
bless
thank you again
you,
for
Jason.
Sitting in for me last week. Bless you, my son. Oh, yes. All that scratching's making me itch. Put on your ghetto blaster, get out your lino and the leg warmers, spin on your head to the hip-hop tunes of Cut It, Reflex, Ollie and Jerry. Yes, breakdance is back. I was first in line at the Harrow ABC, standing in line, doing all that with my hands up and down like a wave with my friends. First in line to see Breakdance the movie when it came out, and its sequel, Breakdance 2, Electric Boogaloo. They are re-released in DVD glory to celebrate their 25th anniversary. Just to remind you of the plot, not really that that's what they were about. A struggling jazz dancer played by Lucinda Dickey teams up with two hot breakdancers from the streets, one played by Adolfo Shabadoo Quinones, the other played by Michael Boogaloo Shrimp Chambers, and they try to win a big-time dance competition. Will they be allowed in by the stuffy academy, these street hoodlums? What do you think?
We seem to have a problem here.
I'll take care of it.
Well, I'm very much afraid they won't be able to dance for us.
And why not?
Because I don't think they'll fit into our particular production.
How can you say that? You haven't even seen them perform.
Look, I'm sorry, but we're looking for some very good jazz dancers. And it's been made very clear to me that those people don't fit into that particular category.
Look, they're here. Just let them dance.
Look, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
They're not going to stop us now.
Who's next?
Ozone! Street dancer!
That's the sound of breakdance, and I'm delighted to say that Adolfo Shabadoo Quinones joins me on the line from Los Angeles now. Adolfo, welcome to Film Weekly. What a great pleasure it is to speak to you after all this time. I was first in line, as I was saying earlier, to see your film in 1984 when it came out here in the UK as Breakdance. So it's a great honour to meet one of the icons of dance, if I may say.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Are you still wearing the same gear? Because, I mean, some of that stuff was tight-fitting, Adolfo. I worry.
No. I don't wear some of the same gear. I do try to change with the times a little bit. So if you look, if you sit back and you watch the films now, you'd see, oh my God, the bandana around his waist, the whole look. He's really Zorro, you know, minus the mask itself.
Absolutely, and the little dangly earring thing. Was that made out of bone?
Well, actually, it's a bone that I purchased in the airport while on tour with Lionel Richie. And I purchased, I think it was in a place like Madagascar or somewhere like that.
Because your films, as I say, they're out on DVD here in the UK again to celebrate their 25th anniversary. So it's not just Breakdance the movie, it's Breakdance 2, Electric Boogaloo, a film which I also remember seeing. They really caught a kind of wave, it certainly here in Britain, because no one had really put Breakdance into a movie sort of setting. I've seen, and I still have, Wild Style, but that was a very kind of raw documentary, if you like.
Right,
it was
right.
About the B-boy scene. And your films, now I see them again, they're very bright, they're very well produced. They must have been made very quickly on a low budget, but they're very professionally done.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Most people ask me, well, what separated or differentiated your film from the pack? I think Breaking, in particular, showed the multicultural face that it eventually became, hip-hop became. We weren't perceived as a niche market sort of culture at that point. Especially when you have, a white girl in it, you have two, Puerto Rican and a black kid and various Asians and all these sorts of things. So when people came to the Breaking movie, they said, wow, I see my face in that movie. And that wasn't always the case with hip hop. Initially, it was a very niche market, very closed, ethnic-centric type of culture.
Yeah.
It wasn't as inclusive as it is now. And so that film, in that way, I think was very important to show that hip-hop was something for everyone.
But interestingly, at the time, it was the dance movie was kind of getting a revamp. It was back, Flashdance was doing it. Then I suppose your movie influenced Michael Jackson's Beat It videos and the Bad LP and all these kind of words. Was it the first time that they were actually sort of put into the mainstream as a movie? Is that why the movie became such a phenomenon?
I think so. I think it's all of those reasons. How do you really define or explain the birth of a culture? It's something that happens very slowly and for many different reasons. It's for all those reasons that we had the kind of success that we had.
No one's going to say to you that they had the most original plots in the world. I mean, you had to, win the battle in the first film and win the competition.
Yeah.
And do that. I love those dance movies because there's always like the really kind of stern woman who's on the panel and she has to tap a fit and goes, these guys aren't bad, really.
Great shots
of that. And then your second one is a real, like a Mickey and Judy story, a Garland and Rooney story where let's do the show right here to save the community hall,
Yeah, we're going to save the world and cure cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. But dance can do that, Adolfo.
I think we can take those kind of fantasy trips if we want to. I think musically you can do that. Again, we're coming out of that whole sort of, the musical, the music video genre was new, as exciting frontier. So a lot of like fantasy types of things were coming up at that point. People dancing on the ceilings, and but I think we're coming around it ourselves again.
That's what I was going to ask.
People wanting to feel good again.
I really enjoyed seeing them. Are you still listening to the music as well? Because I mean, in my car, maybe I'm just too retro, but in my car, I'm still got Ollie and Jerry, Ain't No Stopping Us. I've still got that Al Jarreau track that's in the first one. I Get My Boogie Down. That's in your song. I mean, I'm still listening to that.
Oh yeah,
it's still
on,
right?
I listen to all those and new ones. And I listen to, I use them in my workshops.
Right.
Young people love that stuff.
That electro and the scratching, it's still going on.
Yeah, still going on.
Well, Adolfo.
It's never going to go away, ever. So get used to it.
It's just the outfits that change.
Just the outfits have changed a bit, and now it's coming back to wearing the outfits again.
I know, I'm getting sweatbands and headbands all over again.
It's all cool. They all like that stuff all over again. What's new is old, and what's old is new.
And evermore shall be so. Adolfo Quinones, better known as Shabadoo. Do you still get called Shabadoo?
Yes, I do.
Okay, by your mum?
My friends call me Shab.
Excellent.
But yeah, Shabadoo.
Well, I'm going to call you Shab because I like to think of you as my breakdancing friend right now, Adolfo.
Okay, well, let's be friends. Why not?
Excellent. Let's join hands and do a wave. Can we still do that?
Yeah.
The electro wave.
An electro wave, you know what they call it? Yeah. When you start sending waves from body to body.
Yeah.
Those were the days. That and the kickworm.
Oh, you're sending me into a spin, Adolfo Quinone. Adolfo Quinones, thanks very much for joining us on Film Weekly, and congratulations on enduring so well for Breakdance, the movie, and Breakdance 2, which are out on DVD here in the UK from the 6th of April. That is all we've got time for. The property developers are moving in and closing down the community centre. What are we going to do? Let's dance the night away. Film Weekly comes to an end. My thanks to all my guests this week, to Michael Nyman, to Zan Brooks, and of course to Shabadoo there. I've been Jason Solomon. It's been a pleasure being back after a few weeks away and to be in harness with my producer, Sarah Peters, again. Goodbye.